Where do we start this? And the answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. Sure. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay.
Welcome to the Sell or Die podcast. We're your hosts, Jeffrey
and Jen Gittimer.
I'm the author of The Little Red Book of Selling and 15 other best-selling books and the creator of the Seven-Figure Sales Formula Program. I grew up in Philadelphia, sold in New York City, but was smart enough to move to Charlotte, North Carolina.
And I'm the author of Sales in the New York Minute and creator of Breakthrough Business Babe Community. Fun fact, I'm obsessed with our dogs and consider them humans. If you have a dog, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Sell or Die is for sales professionals, salespeople, sales managers, entrepreneurs, and business owners who want to sell more at full price, earn loyalty, and have an unlimited stream of referrals.
Every single episode is going to give you real-world, easy-to-implement solutions so that you can get your calls returned, your proposals read and acted on, all while creating relationships that you can take all the way to the bank.
It's time to sell or die. We are blessed today to be joined from internationally. This is a global podcast episode, all the way from Montreal, Canada. We are joined by the great Mitch Joel, who has written Six Pixels of Separation, Control-Alt-Delete, and is friends with Seth Godin. I mean, there's a trio that cannot be beat. He is smart. He is funny. He is a global speaker who is currently not speaking. And we're going to talk about what that means in the new world as we emerge into the new normal. Please help me welcome my friend, the great Mitch Joel.
Woo!
Hello.
Hey,
yeah. I was thinking, you know, Jeffrey, if we lined you, me, and Seth up and took a picture, you'd have Juman Group right there.
Exactly. Juman Group is true. I told you a couple of years ago in a restaurant, I want to do a seminar series called Bald Ideas. And it could work if Godin would come off the dime. You and I would do it in a heartbeat. But I think it's only, he's a reluctant warrior.
I would like to see what it would take for Jen to join.
Exactly.
We can talk to my hairdresser, Kenna, about that, but I don't think she's going to allow that.
Yeah.
So but I want to know, this for speakers especially, this new normal is very different. Talk to us about what you were doing before and what this transition has been like for you.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was doing 40 to 60 events a year. I was coming into 2020 from December with more revenue for 2020 than my entire 2019 year. I've just been on the up and up with speaking. It's probably been about 15 years professionally that I've been doing it. You know, a bit of the backstory to that is that I was running a digital marketing agency called Twist Image that did quite well as one of the larger independent agencies in North America that I sold to WPP, which is one of the largest public companies that does these sort of roll-ups and is one of the largest networks in the world. We then took that business and turned it into an agency called Mirum, which was 3,000 people in 30 countries when I left about 2 years ago. And when I left 2 years ago, I took a small office space following in Jeffrey's sort of headspace. He gets to walk across the corridor. I just go, you know, 700 feet-ish down the street into a really nice studio space with one of my business partners. And my real strategy was I'm going to talk, I'm going to invest, I'm going to advise, I'm going to create content like I've been doing with my Six Pixels of Separation. It's probably the longest running podcast. I don't think there's anybody with maybe the exception of Leo Laporte who's done a podcast for as long as I have consistently, especially in the business space, there's probably no one like it. And it's still, you know, I write 3-4 times a week as well. And so I was coming into 2020, you know, feeling great. You know, I had my successful business that I had an exit on. I had 2 years of speaking that had been building and building off the fact that it had been building and building for over a decade. And then this happened. And the analogy I tell my friends is like, it's like sitting at the airport and you're watching all the departure flights go to canceled. That was my speaking career. And so while many people like the other bald gentleman in this conversation have been like, I'm going to go 9:59 live and just go for it, I've really struggled with it because I don't think video is the same as live. As I've done my, and listen, I'm a digital communications person from day one. And back in the late 80s, I was publishing print magazines that I put on an internet before there was an internet. Like I wrote an article in the early 90s about the internet because the great innovation at the time was hyperlinks. The fact that you could go from one page to another without having to type in the web address at the top. I'd launched one of the first search engines. I'd been involved in mobile content. So I understand this domain. What I understand also this domain is you have to really be a different type of character with a different type of content. And I'm not there, you know, so here we sit a couple months into this thing and I don't have that level of confidence and comfort that Jeffrey does every morning at 9:59. And I also think that the world that Gittimer.com has occupied for the years that I've known all of you is on e-learning. You've been doing this for so long. And I think it's very sort of unrealistic for me as a speaker to come in and go, I'm a virtual speaker now. I got a green screen and I got a good mic and I got a lav and I bought two lights on Amazon. All of a sudden, everybody is a virtual speaker and they get it and they're so smart. And I'm like, dude, I've spent 20 years watching the e-learning business come into its own. The event planners are not the same people at learning and development or at the same people at HR. And they are used to buying and licensing video content, and they're used to buying it in a very, very different and dynamic way. So to a certain degree, my reaction in a very long-winded way, Jen, has been to sit it out, to really sit it out, to really think about what I will do when I hit the stage, when those stages come back, to focus on my podcast, to focus on collecting conversations, to take notes, to think, to write. Because if I am going to start a new business, which I ran my own business for so long that I sold, I don't think the business that I want to start is me selling a webinar. So that's where I'm at.
I'm going to challenge you. You're not sitting it out. You're doing it out. You're doing your podcast, you're writing, you're compiling content, you're getting ready to give your next speech, even though you haven't given it yet and don't know when. You're blessed enough to have enough reserve so that you can sit it out. You don't have to worry about where your next meal is going to come from. And just by the way, parenthetically, we have four lights and we bought them from B&H, but that allows us. You know, we used to have those big heavy lights that cost $2,500 and a bulb cost $500. And now it's like $300 and they're better lights.
But look, I told you, we just came off of recording my podcast, which again, thank you so much for doing, Jeffrey. And I told the story, which is that I do 100 conversations a year. I do 60 stages a year. I do countless other things. I collect conversations and people and relationships. Mm-hmm. And with that, one of the greatest experiences I've ever had was coming to your home and just spending time in the library and hanging out and getting time to spend with you. My other real memory was you were really figuring it out back then. And I guess what my reaction is to Jen saying, so what are you doing, is I find there's too many people faking it. And in the world of sales, I think you can fake it a little bit, but if you're getting paid $30,000 to get up on stage and speak, and you think you're worth $30,000 because you bought two lights on Amazon and a clip-on mic, I'm here to tell you that it takes a lot more to be good at this than just turning on a video camera and pumping your slides in. That's all. It's just that attitude.
So, Jen, I gave Mitch the idea of just start creating your legacy right now of the 15 rules of life from Mitch Joel. And you can control your life, you can alternate your circumstances, and you can delete all the shit. And that becomes your next book because you already have one. You need a sequel to it anyway. But I think that Mitch has everything that he needs except missing his own key, and that is his desire to do it.
Yeah. Well, there's that. And there's also just like, I'm Canadian, which immediately makes me extremely apologetic, extremely sort of like, do people want to hear, you know, the biggest difference I see mostly between Americans and Canadians, besides the American sort of internal freedom, this sort of just drive for freedom, is is that sort of like, I sold my company for $150 million. If anybody put out the number for what I sold my company for, I'd probably curl up in the corner and be very, very embarrassed for myself and everybody who knows. It's a different characteristic.
It's definitely an American thing to share that and be comfortable sharing those numbers. And I think more so even the circles I've been running in with digital entrepreneurs, they share numbers. I just had a $6 million launch. I just had a $300,000 launch. They share numbers like it's nothing. And then when I go talk to other people who aren't in their industry, they're like, oh, whoa, are you sure you feel comfortable talking to me about your numbers? Yeah. And I'm like, well, yeah, they're just facts. Like their history, they're the numbers. They're the numbers of the numbers. Like,
you really see the cultures. Like, you know, where's an entrepreneurial culture? Where's there more of a sales culture? Where's there more of a branding culture? Where do personal brand? Like, part of the challenge when I'm speaking to people about building their brand, I really look at it as a purely cultural function. It's like, I don't think it's in your culture to do this. And it's interesting. You have to really change who you are to be able to do that.
So, yeah, I agree. I want to go back to something you said at the beginning, which is this distinction between sitting it out and thinking it out or doing it out, as Jeffrey pointed out. That was coincidental.
That was very Dr. Seuss poem there.
I couldn't have planned that if I tried, because I think that, you know, Jeffrey's also made this similar distinction between the winners, the watchers, and the whiners. And when you said sitting it out, I'm like, no, there's no way. And then immediately went into, and so by sitting it out, what I mean is I'm doing this podcast and I'm collecting these conversations. And it's like, you're doing all these things to build the foundation of whatever it is next. And the way I look at it is you're almost slowing down to speed up. And rather than just jumping into something, you're thinking, okay, what is it that you want to build? And I think that that is so cool that you have the ability to take the time and luxury to do that. Because I think that some of our diehards are, you know, they've just, some of them have emailed me, they've been furloughed, they've been laid off, they're trying to figure it out. And some are investing in themselves and taking courses and trying to get to that next level. And others, I don't know if I'd call them diehards, but others are really sitting it out.
But what I would jump in on is you're right. And this is a thing of acceleration. So the challenge that somebody like me has in this moment is you have to frame time and speed at the same moment. For me, I was running an agency, have a very young family, was speaking 40 to 60 times a year and still pumping out 5 to 7 pieces of content. So when you take away the agency and you take away suddenly a third of my time with speaking, I went from going 300 miles an hour to 180 miles an hour, which I recognize is way faster than every other person. But for me, it feels differently. Mm. And so people are now saying, you know, now it's chaos. It's not, you know, it's time to reflect. And I'm like, I've been doing it for 2 years. I got it. Like, my timing just happened to be very weird with this whole thing. So yes, it's given me a bit more runway to run at a slower click, fully recognizing that I am not really building so much as adding and trying to figure out if I'm going to add in a new business model. It has to be something that satiates me more than, you know, an online course, let's say. It's that type of thinking.
That totally makes sense.
And you have never really slowed down. You've just used your time in a different way.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, is your time any less full? Like, what, you have an empty schedule today? No.
No. The blessing of people like the three of us is that even if I said yes, the answer is no.
Right, exactly.
Because it's not like you go, well, so what is that stuff on Netflix that everyone's talking about? It's, I don't know. I got 6 books loaded up on my Kindle. I have no
clue. What's Netflix?
You're right. Yeah. I have no idea.
Unlike my kids, who I believe have finished Netflix, but that's a conversation for another.
Exactly.
I'm pretty sure Gabrielle has finished Netflix too.
But here's the deal. The other day, let's call it a week and a half ago or whatever, I see Mitch's name on my Facebook Live. And I go, oh, Mitch Joel's here. It's like, it's like I'm being visited by the King of Siam. And I spent time, I literally dwelled on the fact that Mitch was there. I probably accoladed him way more than he was worth. But the fact is, I did it because I felt it in my soul. We have several things in common, not simply religion, but fathers who have passed. And that's a huge in common piece that most people don't realize, that we're relying on remembered wisdom rather than wisdom you can tap in on. And we shared that a little bit on our talk this morning. And he gave me a story that he's been retelling about me and my dad for years. And I'm sitting there. Thank God he was telling the story because I was crying.
Well, listen, we're hitting a very strange day to record. This is actually my father's birthday today. So it's also like, I'm getting emotional thinking about it. But the story that I was saying to Jeffrey is one, it's become mythology in my life. And I didn't even know if he told it to me privately, if this is something I read in one of his books or some a story from stage. But it impacted me in a huge way. And it started because I'd been joining the 959 meetings and really enjoying them. And definitely lurking in the background. I don't need anybody to go, Mitch is here. It's again, I'm Canadian. I don't like that type of recognition. But the note-taking thing has always been a huge thing. So Jeffrey talked about notes. I jumped in and said, notes. I collect notebooks. I collect pens. I can show you stacks and stacks of notebooks and papers and pens. And if I even did a shot now over to one of my bookshelves here, you'll see that one shelf is just blank notebooks. Like I literally collect notebooks.
I do too.
Yeah, it's an addiction. It's not pretty. But the story is that I remembered Jeffrey telling a story of his father, how Jeffrey would be on the floor as a kid, like watching TV or listening to the radio. Father would come into this sort of living room with the big old chair and the slippers and the pipe and the newspaper, this after a long day work, and sort of, you know, sit down in the chair. But that he always had, you know, a pad of paper and notes and was taking notes and taking notes. And one day Jeffrey said, like, what are you doing? And his father very quickly said back, I'm doing my homework. And essentially he was taking notes on either the day and stuff he had to do or a to-do list for tomorrow. But it had such a deep, it tattooed me. Like it literally was a thing where I was like, yeah, I don't ever want to be caught not taking notes. I don't ever want to be caught not doing my homework. And so I was asking Jeffrey because I wasn't sure if this was even a true story. And we had a really incredible moment because it's very true. So I'm glad it was. But it's still mythology.
Exactly. Yeah, there's nothing like mythology. The fish gets bigger, but in this particular one, the fish has stayed the same size.
Right. But again, it's an amazing thing. When people talk to me about like they want me to be their mentor or they want me to be their advisor, I think about like, who is my mentor and who is my advisor? And the truth is Jeffrey is every single day, all the time.
Aww.
I haven't spoken to him in forever, but he is because I can pick up his books. I can watch the video. I can get the newsletter. I could listen to an audiobook. I can pick up a first edition that I have right here of the Sales Bible. I don't need to bother a human being for them to be a mentor or advisor in my life. And the magic of the story of Jeffrey's father and homework is that sometimes you're a father to your kids and sometimes you're a father to every kid. And that's an instance where through Jeffrey was a mentor to me because I become like Columbo. I'm like writing everything down for people who remember Columbo. It's an old man reference.
I used to see it on the funny,
even in this, I've created this course called The New Normal, and I'm explaining to salespeople how to get back into sales without selling anything by asking their customers what's been going on. And then my next sentence is, and take notes while they're talking. And then how can I help you? And take notes while they're talking, because number one, it will show you an opportunity. But number two, if you talk to 10 people, it's going to create a trend.
Yeah, and even bigger than that, one of the other things I found extremely powerful is Julia Cameron wrote a book called The Artist's Way. It's a great book. And listen, while we're sitting here being quarantined or whatever this is called at this point, it's an amazing program. But there are two things you need to know about Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way. One is the artist date, which is every week or month, give yourself an artist date. Now, what does that mean? It could be going to a concert, but it could be something as stupid as going to the dollar store, buying a couple things and trying to build something. It could just be reading poetry or something you don't read. And I think that is another way to open yourself up to other creative things that might get your thinking working. But the most profound thing that she talks about and teaches is something called morning pages, which is when you wake up, the first thing you do is long form with a pen and paper, write 3 pages, don't stop. It's stream of consciousness. It's not stream of consciousness. It's a notes about what you got to pick up at the grocery store. It's how you feel about your kids that day. It's whatever you want. And the idea is that you're almost cleaning out the gunk of everything that's in there and putting it on paper. You're to never use it. It is not for material. It's not source material. It's not for the article you got to write later. But that is an amazing primer that basically lubricates you to write, to think creatively, to think in that way. And it's a practice I've been doing for a long time. And when you speak to a lot of major artists and you get into the mechanics of it, which you'll hear about in places like in Tim Ferriss's podcast, he'll talk to Elizabeth Gilbert, brilliant book, Big Magic, killer book on creativity and writing. And you see that most people have this morning pages thing going on. And that's been another thing, which is also like, it just, I'm primed to take notes. I mean, I just did 3 pages of it before I did anything else. So it's great.
I have to tell you that I do it at night. I write all my shit down at night. Yeah. And Jen and I just shared something. The minute you talked about The Artist Way and Julie Cameron, I'll bet $1,000 right now in cash that Jen wrote it down.
Let's go to the screen, everybody.
Hold on. Okay. And so did I. And that's how it's like the mind collect. Like you're going to give me this tip. Like, okay, great. I better... Right, exactly.
I need it.
But my only reaction was, how many first editions does Jeffrey have and how many are signed? That was my only thought as I was saying it.
But here's the deal. We have practiced The Artist Way without knowing that that's what we're supposed to do. And I've been doing it literally since 1967, going to art museums, going to reading books,
gardens,
going to concerts. Yeah. All the things that you do, like when we go to Paris, we sit in a garden and just hang, hoping a bird doesn't crap on our head.
I bet things are so crazy right now, you would hope the bird would crap on your head, right? It's yeah, wild,
you
know?
No, it's happened to me in Montmartre, and I'm telling you, you don't want it to happen to you.
Someone said to me the other day, you know, I can't wait to just get together and have a coffee with you. And I said, I can't wait to get together with anybody and have a coffee with them.
Oh, man. I love the concept of being creative as an adult and going to a craft store and just buy, like going to Michael's or wherever. Do you have Michael's in Canada?
We do. Yeah, we do.
Okay. For sure. And just buying, you know, some craft stuff, because every time I've done craft stuff with Gabrielle, like last night we did a puzzle, a gradient puzzle, which is 1,000 pieces and it's going to kill me, but we're going to solve it. And sometimes we'll do vision boards and other stuff like that. There's such a big release in when you're just really focused on that task that when you walk away from it, all of a sudden, all the other things in your business, it's so easy to become creative in all those other things in your business because you've like gotten everything out in the art form.
Well, people also think that they're not creative, which makes me crazy. I mean, just take a pencil and one of those notebooks and just, you know, people, I don't know how to draw. Just fire up a YouTube video on how to draw and you'll see like it actually, if you figure out to move quickly and keep your pencil light, there's always an eraser. You'd be surprised at the level of creativity you can have. Watercolors is another great example. People think they can't paint. Like, it's simpler than you think. It's not easy to master. Not everyone's going to be a great painter, a great drawer, a great artist, a great writer. But there is nothing even, I would even say, pick up a book from a subject you are no interest in. Pick up an author that you had never heard of. Pick up a book from 50 years ago. Pick up a book from 100 years ago. Pick up a magazine that you'd never think to look at. All of this are amazing triggers that will open up new doors and pathways.
So when we do these in-person get-togethers here where we give like a tour of the library and people get to meet with Jeffrey and it's a whole day event, it's really cool. It's a VIP experience. I would say one of the top 5 questions when they're seeing the creativity section of Jeffrey's library is, so how do I get creative?
Read a fucking book on creativity. That would be like number one.
But like legit, like so many people feel, oh, wow. Jeffrey's holding up.
This is holding up my computer right now at eye level.
But so many people feel like they're not creative.
Yeah. So, you know, Jeffrey held up the copy of Tinker Toys. And like when it comes to writing, I would hold up probably The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield, which is, I like things that, to get me started. So here's the way I think. Like I used to play music. I actually still have a podcast where I interview bass players because I used to play the electric bass. And what I've learned in the new world of music instruments, because it's actually a space I've done a lot of speaking in too, is that if you buy a guitar and you are not playing one or two songs out of the gate, you're going to drop it. You're never going to play. If I start to on notes and scales and phrasings and chordings, you're not going to stick to it. It's hard. It hurts your fingers. You don't have calluses. You don't have rhythm. It's going to suck. But if I can get you to play a song, you'll keep going at it.
Yeah.
And in fact, Fender has started a program called Fender Play, where the idea is if you buy the guitar, it's like an online digital training thing. But the idea is just get them playing a song because that's what's going to keep the person going. I actually think that when you ask that question about, you know, how do you start with creativity, Jen? I think we got to get people there faster, like clunking them down the book, like Tinker Toys is like, and I got to read a book. So my gateway is usually I send them one or two little sort of documentaries or things that interest them from YouTube. Of people talking about art or how they do art or how they write or how they think about writing. By the way, Masterclass is a great example of that as well, where you can get very inspired. You could watch Gordon Ramsay and care less about cooking or him, and you will be inspired to try something. So I'm always a big believer in giving somebody something that gets them there right away. Like I want 7 minutes and I'm gone. Mm-hmm. So anything creative for me has to be one of those quick, and that's why I like The War of Art. When people talk about writing, I'm like, you can read it in 2 hours if you're really slow.
Yeah, it's a short book.
Yeah, for sure. I met him. I met Presley. In fact, I wanted to do Pressfield. I mean, I wanted to do a thing with him about having a writing retreat because he's really a good writer, but he's also not unlike you. He doesn't want to be a public person.
No.
He has an email that he sends out, which I read. I met him at Victoria Labam's wedding, and he's a great guy. He's a thinker. He's an incredible writer.
Yeah, I've had him on the show once. You're right. But part of it is the story of the War of Art. Like, he just wants to write. And anything he's doing that isn't writing is what he calls resistance. And there's another mutual connection. I speak to Victoria all the time, and she's one of the greatest people in the world. So I love Victoria Labam. Yeah.
So, okay, in the beginning, you mentioned you're collecting conversations, and that's not a term I've actually ever heard. I hear people say, I'm having a conversation or I'm going to talk to someone, but you seem to use that term on purpose. So talk to us about what that is.
Well, I can't thank anybody for that term except for the man you're married to, Jeffrey Gittimer, because Jeffrey said that your network is your net worth. And that's exactly where it's from. I realize that the more conversations I have with people, the more that I can collect from that, which is either in note-taking or recording and sharing it in a podcast or having that information and it turning into something that helps me or turning into a slide for a presentation or turning into an idea for one of my clients or it turns into an idea for me to invest in or advise in, that's what my somewhat unique skill set or ability is. I think I am good at having conversation. I think I am good at getting things out of people that not only provide value to them, but actually in some subversive way provide more value to me. It's not selfish.
Right. But no, like I was saying, it is totally selfish and it's fine.
It is selfish. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. And I always say that my podcast is the most selfish activity I do. It's like, there's this new author who's the genius of the blockchain. I've heard of the blockchain. I know what it is. How do I get to speak to the number one person in that space? I know, I'll create a podcast and I'll invite them on. And it literally has been the gateway for my speaking, for everything. Everything that I have has been generated because of a conversation before it and my ability to come into that conversation, thinking, being open to hearing what the other person says, letting them finish their sentence, letting them have a thought. I can take notes while they think and then thinking, where do I want this to go versus I have all these questions that I need you to answer. It doesn't work like that for me.
No.
So I collect those.
That's really cool. And Die Hard, I think it's important for you to listen to the difference between just meeting with a customer and going in to meet with a customer with the intention to collect the conversation. And how differently would you approach that meeting when you have that intention behind it versus when you're just going in to meet with the customer? Like, it totally changes your frame. It totally changes your prep and everything you're going to do. And you immediately walk in with a pen because you're ready to collect the conversation.
It's not just what are you selling, it's what are you learning? Yeah. And if you go in thinking, I think I can learn something from this, either the experience or the person or the circumstance, you're going to leave as a winner, whether you've sold something or not.
My life for 15 years was pitching. And that was my life. You are an agency, a marketing agency. You are living and dying off of how often you're pitching. And more importantly, how often you're winning those pitches. And you get, you deal with a lot of procurement. You deal with a lot of RFPs and a lot of sort of like, we want everybody as the agencies that are coming in to present with us to be vanilla in the sense of we want you to answer the same questions so that we can gauge you against one another. And I would do everything I can from studying everything I could from Jeffrey to many others of thinking about how do you break that cycle? How do you be unique? How do you stand out? All those things. We had a series of pitches that didn't go well. And you walk out of the pitch and you go, no energy. They didn't like us. We didn't like them. It's like a concert, right? Some nights the band is killing it on stage and they can feel it. Some nights, even if the audience loves it, they get off stage and like, that was the worst ever. And I was in, you know, one of the sort of real anchors of this that fits into my long-winded answer to this conversation is we were in a pitch and it was bad. And I interrupted one of my team members that was speaking, and it was a big room on their side. I'd say 7 or 8 people on our side. And I just said, this isn't working. This isn't what you want. You're clearly not taking this information as what you need. So either we should get up and walk out of here, which I don't want to do because I think we can do great stuff together. But I would like to have a conversation about why this isn't working and what you want to have happen. We didn't win the business. I mean, there's not a happy ending to this, but it was a big moment when I realized that just because everybody has a script doesn't mean you have to follow the script. And when it comes to these moments of selling and being present, you have to be careful. You have to know your audience for sure. But in this case, I had nothing to lose. We weren't getting that business anyway. So I'd rather just be able to sit back and hear what they were looking for, take notes and say, you know what, it probably isn't the right fit, then just walk out. That like we survived. We made it through all 37 slides, right? Like it's such a stupid mindset.
I want to say it's the second or third speech I ever gave. I was in front of the Screen Printing Association because I was a big time screen printer. And they asked me to give a talk about making sales in textile screen printing, t-shirts. And I had all these notes and I'm in front of people that are the industry leaders, literally the BVDs and the manufacturers and the equipment and the big guys. And I start to give a talk and I could hear that my talk sucked.
Yeah, God, the worst.
I have these papers in front of me. And after about, I'm going to say like 10 minutes, I go, hey, something just occurred to me. This blows. And I took my notes. I wish I had them, but I don't. Because I ripped them in half, balled them up, and threw them on the ground. I said, here's what we're going to do for the next hour. You're going to tell me every objection you've ever had in sales, and I'm going to overcome it. Fair enough? And people are just screaming out all kinds of shit. My business is for sale. The guy said my price was too high. My father-in-law just died. Whatever the deal was, I would sit there for over an hour and talk about their sales objections. And I ended up selling everything. I had a little tape that I was selling. I sold every single one of those. I got a standing ovation from people that were so happy that I canned my speech, I think, more than I gave a great talk. And it was the beginning of me understanding that extemporaneous wins over preparation sometimes.
Well, it's a really hard, it goes back to like this preparation idea, right? Like when I watched you go live in March, whenever it was that you started doing your daily live meetings, Jeffrey, my reaction wasn't, oh, good, here's some free Jeffrey content. I'm just going to siphon off of him. Like, where's the truck? Let me get that tube into the gas tank and get everything I can out of it. My reaction really was decades of him preparing for this moment. Decades. And whether you knew it and the audience definitely didn't know it, that's part of the skill that people like you and I and Jen have in our métier of the work that we do. It's that if I have to do this, I am ready to do this versus, well, I guess I'll go on Facebook and go live. And then without a plan, without experience, without having thought it through, it can be really challenging. And I think your ability to say that in an audience speaks to your skills, what you had developed up until that moment. Because I remember doing one for like a local, you know, Rotary sort of club. And all I was thinking was just get to that last page. I think there's two of them left now. I think there's one of them left. And it's just like, how can I get out of here without requiring Kevlar? right? Because in our brains too, we think that this is the work. That's how you need a certain level of experience. And again, I wish I could go back to that gig now because I would have done probably exactly that. But that to me is one of the biggest lessons that we can learn in speaking, in selling, in creating, is to a certain degree, I don't mind fake it till you make it. I don't know where either of you stand on that theology, but I'm a much bigger fan of boxing in your weight class. You know, it's like, I'm not going to go for the heavyweight title yet. I'm okay doing the welterweight or doing the YMCA rounds or the Golden Gloves to get to that point, because I think you can just chalk up a lot of wins really quickly when you're boxing in your weight class. Too often people just think, I'm just going to, and look, it can work. Sometimes that works. I'm just more of a fan of boxing in your weight class.
Yeah, I think on the internet now, everyone thinks they're an expert, they're a writer, they're a content creator, they're all of the things because they did one thing. And I'm not saying like don't have belief in yourself. Obviously, you need belief in yourself. You have to start. Everyone started somewhere, but don't overestimate how much knowledge or expertise you have. And like I see people every day who are like, I'm the next Jeffrey Gittimer. And I'm like, first of all, why don't you be the next whoever you are and be yourself? Like, I love Jeffrey, obviously. Like, I'm the president of his fan club, but go be yourself. That's how Jeffrey got to be Jeffrey Gittimer, right? He was himself. And second of all, like, no, you're not. You're not.
But you are you. You know, you are uniquely.
Oh, totally.
And there is so much magic in that.
Yes.
Let me go with fake it till you make it. My expression has always been live it in advance. And that way you're projecting yourself rather than faking it. That's number one. Number two, somebody asked me the other day, how long did it take you to write the little gold book of Yes Attitude? And I told him 60 years.
Exactly.
Because it's not a 3-month project. It's a project that has to do with the collective ideas and things, experiences that have happened to you in your lifetime.
But that's the problem. That's the big problem, though, I find today with these whole virtual keynotes and virtual meetings, is that they are down pricing because of the physicality or technical, like it's not as great, but the value of the content, like you're not paying me for that keynote. You're paying me for the 30 years it took for me to be able to stand up in front of you and deliver that. But I do find to what Jen is saying, and a little bit to what you're saying, Jeffrey, that it's very challenging on digital to quantify that because of the freeness of it and the ability. And I talked about this in my book 15 years ago, right? Anybody can have an idea and broadcast it in text, images, audio, and video instantly and for free to the world. And so when that drops, the value of it drops, you move from scarcity into abundance. And to a certain degree, people will devalue it. That all being said, as Jen said earlier, there are these online people, these online trainers who have figured out the path to really maintain the price to quality ratio, which is so challenging online. It really is.
I agree. I totally agree. When 9/11 hit, I was in Las Vegas giving a talk to a group of fast food store managers from the West Coast. And the CEO, a large company, was like 350 people in the room, wanted to cancel the meeting. And I said, what are you doing that for? I said, people are going to go back to the room and watch a plane hit a building 200 times and then not know what to do. I said, let me give a 45-minute talk on positive attitude. And if they like it, we keep going. And if they don't like it, forget it. They can go back to the room then. And the guy said, okay, let's do that. 4.5 hours later, I was still talking. And I had prepared for 20 years to give that talk, not last night. Because last night's preparation had nothing to do with the Twin Towers going down.
But there is an analogy to live in that, Jeffrey, right? Which is that the problem is most people click on live and go, now what? When the reality is what you're doing is spending 7 hours before you click the button. So you know exactly what's going to happen when you click live. Mm-hmm. And it's such a different world out there. I mean, I don't know about you, but I do a lot of eye rolling, a lot of deleting, a lot of signing up for webinars, and I'll just watch the replay. Probably not, but I'll sign up for it and I'll take the email link later.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, but this is what people don't understand. Get ready, get set, go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The get ready part takes years and they're not willing to get ready. They want to just go.
Well, everyone wants a quick fix in this kind of market and our world. We're used to fast food and fast things. And when the internet page doesn't load in 1 second, people are like, oh my God, it's broken.
A kid, meet me for lunch, a speaker, and he's just literally, you know, 15 feet away from here. And he said, hey, Jeffrey, where's the money in the speaking business? And I said, I don't think I'm really the right person to ask for that, because I'll tell you what I've done. I just started to do what I loved and talk about it. And that has, you know, blossomed into a very successful career. And he goes, yeah, yeah, but where's the money? I'm like, schmuck.
But that is a big part. I mean, that's been to me the biggest change in the speaking industry, I would say, in the past 15 years. This sort of, it's a profession. Like, what do you do? I'm a professional speaker. I'm like, yeah, it's working for many. But my whole thing is do enough things that are interesting and winning and experience-based and knowledgeable that people want you to speak. And then it just so happens you're really great at delivering that content versus what should I speak about? How do you make money? I'm like, I don't know if that's, mm-hmm. apparently it is, but it's shocking to me that people are professional speakers, not people who have done stuff who are then paid to professionally express and emote how to do that successfully.
That's such a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, very and deep.
Yeah.
So if you don't have enough experience, go out and dig ditches for a while. And if you have blisters and you recover from the blisters, come on and tell me about what it's like to dig.
There you go. Wait,
look, how many friends do we have who haven't changed their speech in 20 years because there's only so many times you can climb Mount Everest and talk about it?
Yeah, I can only do it once,
maybe twice.
There was a guy named Ira Hayes who worked for NCR for a long time and then became a speaker. And his expression was, it's a heck of a lot easier to change audiences than it is to change your speech.
Yeah. Yeah. So true.
Oh, ay, ay, ay.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So I have a close friend, Allison Levine, who was one of the few women who have summited all of these. I mean, I literally think she did Everest twice. The first time, missed it by 200 feet, but people, you didn't descend. It's like, yeah, kind of did. Anyways, but it's the same thing. It's like, doesn't need to change the story. The story is the story. No. And again, that is experience versus I'm going to teach you the lessons you could learn from climbing a mountain. I've seen books written about executives or massive businesses, and the person never had access to that executive or the business. And I'm like, okay, it's a bestseller. Like, okay, you can speak about it forever. I'm just like, I don't know how you get up in the morning.
Right.
Right. Oh, man. Okay, so Mitch, where do people go to get your podcast? What's it called? Tell us more so they can find you after this.
One place only. Go to 6pixels.com. You will see everything from the multiple articles I write every week to my weekly show, which is Sunday mornings. It gets published with one thought leader, a long-form conversation. It's been going for over 15 years. And tons of other goodies there in terms of my hits that I do in the media and radio and catch-ups on all things that are related to the intersection of brands, consumers, and technology. So if you're trying to figure out how to really decode the future, that's the content for you.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on our show. This has been awesome.
I got more out of it than you did. That's for sure. Thank you.
No, our audiences will be the winners.
I think I'm the winner, so I'll take it.
Cool. We're all Thank winners, you, damn it.
Yeah, and that's final. And as soon as COVID is at least an ebb, just show up.
I would love that.
Thank you so much for listening to Sell or Die. We hope that this episode has helped you transform the way you think, given you new ideas, and provided you a new perspective on the sales and business challenges that you face every day, so you can get out there and win the customer all the way to the bank.
If you enjoyed this episode, please take a second to rate and review. Each review helps us help more people just like you make a difference in this world. Don't forget to take a screenshot, share it in your Instagram stories, and tag us @Jeffrey Gittimer and @Jen Gittimer.
See you next week.